This is Roger Molina here on Creative Disturbance. I have the pleasure of being with James Ferguson here in Medellin, Colombia, at the Communication of Astronomy with the Public conference. Jamie, you've been working on sonification, and one of the things you talked about in your presentation yesterday, which is going to be described in your upcoming publication, is about how sonification was used in the Voyager mission. So maybe you could just give us that little exemplar of how sonification has practically been used in a scientific project. So over to you.
Yeah, so by all means, the plasma detection should have been quiet, although the detections they were getting it from, it was a particularly loud, noisy signal, loud being quite a ferocious deluge of particles at the time, and they couldn't work out any patterns in this until they sonified this data and then taken advantage of the human ear's ability to perceive patterns and anomalies much more efficiently than the eye can. And then by using this, they managed to make this discovery of the propagation of Saturn's dust ring.
So that was the earliest example of where you found sonification used actually as a research tool rather than an illustration tool.
Mm-hmm.
And so you found a number of other examples, I gather.
Yeah. The main examples that I was then went on to talk about was within astronomy, communication, and outreach. The first being the European Space Agency's coverage of the Rosetta mission and its Philae lander on Comet 67P. Again, the plasma wave instrument on Rosetta was picking up some strange oscillations in the comet's magnetic field, and the team decided to sonify this data, even though they weren't sure what this oscillation was. Releasing the sonification of the data to the public, as at the time was thought of as just a nice engagement tool. However, as I discussed, it ended up becoming something much more important than that, sort of beginning a trend within the Rosetta mission of a sort of symbiotic relationship between the science being discovered and the public being involved in it as well, and using sound as a way to facilitate that.
And the other example that you mentioned, of course, is the recent work with the LIGO, where the sonification kind of went viral.
Yeah.
But then one of the people in the audience kind of asked you the question, which was, wasn't this really science miscommunication? Because the waves that are being sonified there are not sound waves.
Yeah.
And they're not even waves in space. They're waves in time and space. So, and you kind of reacted to that. So why don't you elaborate?
Yeah, this is something that's come up quite a lot, especially within the relationship between sonification and astronomy, especially the confusion between physically hearing something in space and the sonification of something, turning its data into sound. And I think the reaction that people get confused about this quite a lot is maybe slightly overblown. I think most people know that what they're listening to is not physically the sound of something. In most coverages of it, it's quite well explained that this is not actually what the sound is. And as has been kind of discussed quite a lot during this conference, is whether to sort of print the truth or print the myth if it means that someone's going to understand it more. And I think with regards to the public engagement of astronomy, it's getting the basis idea is much more important.
Yeah, and I guess, you know, I had a reaction to that, which I mentioned in in visualization, we're doing a similar kind of translation. So when you see an X-ray image, you're not seeing X-ray.
Yeah, images. Exactly.
You've translated that signal into something that the eye is able to see. But beyond that, I think beyond this question of print the truth or print the myth, is that, in fact, there are different systems of knowledge, and part of the thing in public engagement is to find connections between people's systems of knowledge.
Yeah.
And if a wave phenomenon is a connection, I don't feel too worried about the miscommunication.
Yeah, I would agree. Especially in the specific example of gravitational waves, the idea of a wave is something that we associate quite commonly with sound, as in the waves of the ocean, sound waves, things like that. It's quite an effective way of sort of describing it. As I mentioned before, just solely using the visualization is sometimes maybe slightly more confusing. It's, I think, either a merging of the two, and also just using the sonification itself, which was used quite a lot during the media, just on its own, was quite an effective way of doing this.
Yeah, and you know, as I mentioned also, we use the wave metaphor in quantum mechanics also, and obviously that's not the same kind of wave phenomenon as a water wave or a sand wave. And so, you know, we because of the nature of how we think in language, we use these concepts to bridge phenomena. And so the idea that there's a true way of translating into data from something that you can seize with your senses, I think is misleading in fundamentally. That what we're trying to do is manipulate human perception so they we understand something, and that's what visualization does. So you're going to be joining this group in Scotland at Wish University?
Yeah, I'm joining the multimodal interaction group at the University of Glasgow.
And what do they work on?
So the group there mainly work on creating new ways of interacting with computers, mainly for people with a significant sensory impairment. So, for example, one of the main projects they're working on just now uses a small wristband that goes around a visually impaired person's wrist, and then in public places such as the Park Explorer Science Centre we're here today, similar places like that, there are these small pods placed on the walls, which means that the connection between this wrist device and the devices on the wall allows someone with a visual impairment to navigate their way through these environments without relying on someone constantly taking them through and things like that.
Okay, that's really interesting. A colleague of mine in Dallas, Paul Fishwick, is working on a project which he calls object-driven depersonalization. So basically the idea is the same thing. As you walk by an object, there'll be a Wi-Fi signal, your phone picked up, or a Bluetooth signal, rather. And then you'd suddenly access to additional information about that object. And so in this case, depending on your sensory impairment, and I always joke there's no such thing as a normal human being, because we all have a variability in how each one of our senses works and works together, then indeed the object would trigger maybe different access for someone who's impaired in a particular way rather than a different way. So that would be it's kind of an interesting sort of concept.
Yeah.
And so presumably that means that people walking in around an environment wearing this bracelet would become aware of things that maybe they were not fully aware of.
Yeah, absolutely, especially in sort of public spaces like what I'm talking about, and science centers and things like that, art galleries, things like that.
Very good. So we've kind of covered the territory. This is where we normally get into the podcast and talk about something that's connected.
Yeah.
So what would you like to bring up?
Mainly just what I've been working on. During this conference, I've met a lot of people who are interested in sonification, and especially sonification within astronomy, and also people interested in, as we've just spoke about, people's perception within science and people's perception of science discoveries and its communication of it. So what I'm going to be working on for the next few years during my PhD is trying to find newer ways, simpler ways, cheaper ways in which we can involve three-dimensional sonification, not only in communication of science, but in science itself, in the analysis of data. I'm particularly focusing on astronomy right now, but that doesn't mean that these technologies can't be pushed out further into other sciences like physics, chemistry, whatever.
Yeah, and I think as you mentioned, as you've been working, there seems to be a growing interest in this internationally at the moment. I'm not quite sure what that's driven by, except obviously so many people are now dealing with data sets that never used to deal with data sets. And the whole issue then of how you represent data has just got a growing interest to different kinds of people. So it used to be a specialist topic, but it's now very much an open topic.
Yeah, that's something that I've noticed recently, and especially talking to people here, that interacting with these massive data sets has become unavoidable no matter what field of science you're in. And I think the sort of growth of sonification being taken more seriously and being used in earnest slightly more in science is that people have no option but to find new ways to analyze this data.
Yeah, I was on a thesis committee for a student who just finished from our business school, actually, and he wrote a thesis on the data narrativist.
Okay.
And so the question, you know, his argument was, and he's written a whole thesis, is that indeed when, in his case, people in the business world are now dealing with these large data sets that they've got to show to different kinds of people, you've got to draw on different kinds of narrative traditions, like documentary film or literary practices. And in general, scientists are not very well versed in those techniques.
Yeah.
And so, you know, how you do a narrative that maybe switches modes of perception between visual dominant to sound dominant or combined to help someone get a more sophisticated idea of the content of some data.
Yeah, that's something that I'm particularly interested in. And I think quite a lot of people who are interested in using sonification in science are interested in is this sort of interchangeability between different modes of perception. So not solely moving on from vision and just using sound, not just using touch, but using all of these together in different ways to analyze these data sets. And then also that the nice inherent plus to that is that the outreach side of it then automatically becomes more enriched, especially in the likes of planetariums and things like that.
Well, and it draws on all the literature in the science of learning, which is that actually people have different ways that they learn well.
Yeah.
And some people it's tactile, some people are very visually oriented. Mm-hmm. But for some people, sound is a very good way, actually, of you know, how you capture something in your memory draws on these different modes. Mm-hmm. And so we're about out of time here, so I look forward to staying in touch as you start digging into the topic, and thank you for speaking to Creative Disturbance.
Yeah, thanks.
Okay, very good. Thanks,
thank
Jamie.
You.
Bye-bye.